Good. Thank you so much for being here on this kind of special evening. It's both solemn and hopefully inspiring for all of us, since death is such a close part to human existence. It's whether or not we can hold it both in a solemn and yet inspiring way. We're gonna have a remembrance ceremony tonight. So it's kind of a special night. So welcome. It's a little different than our normal process, but Susan and I will make it work. I'm going to start by chanting Om Mani Padme Om for a little bit, and then we will have Suze read a poem, and then we'll start our sit. So before we actually move into the sit, we're going to do a little bit of chanting and poetry reading. Om Mani Padme Om. 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 Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 Om Mani Padme Om. 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 Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum.
Tuwari and I want to share a poem which we'll be talking about later. It's a poem by Hafiz called Deepening the Wonder. Death is a favor to us, but our scales have lost their balance. The impermanence of the body should give us great clarity, deepening the wonder in our senses and eyes of this mysterious existence we share and are surely just traveling through. If I were in the tavern tonight, Hafiz would call for drinks, and as the master poured, I would be reminded that all I know of life and myself is that we are just a mid-air flight of golden wine between his pitcher and his cup. If I were in the tavern tonight, I would buy freely for everyone in this world, because our marriage with the cruel beauty of time and space cannot endure very long. Death is a favor to us, but our minds have lost their balance. The miraculous existence and impermanence of form always makes the illumined ones laugh and sing. To start, I want to honor tonight those who are currently facing death, whether, you know, in places of war and conflict, those who recently suffered the terrible losses from the mass killings, and those who are facing a scary diagnosis. And then I'd like to return to the poem. Hafiz opens the poem with the line, "Death is a favor to us." And so I've been asking myself, is this true? For me, the first way it's true is that death brought me to the Dharma, to the practice. The grief I felt, the sense of having lost my anchor, my source of strength when my sister died, led me 3 weeks later to my first meditation retreat. And then years later, a scary health diagnosis brought me to Rodney and Blue Spruce, which was the Sangha before Seattle Insight. I think a lot of us, pain and loss are often what brings us to the practice. Sometimes it's not necessarily death, but a sense that things just aren't quite right, a search. It may not be death per se, but it's often a loss or a big change. And change can be a favor to us. changes in our bodies due to aging or health crisis, endings of relationships or jobs, those kinds of changes and losses are often what bring us to the practice. It's for many of us, it's what brought us to Sims. Another way that I think death is a favor to us is by illuminating and deepening our memories of those we love. After our talks this evening, we're going to have a chance to hear from you all about your own memories. And I believe memory is where the love lives when someone dies. And there's a way that when someone close to us dies, that we start to remember things that we hadn't even really paid attention to when they were alive. I remember some years ago in a yoga class, someone walked in wearing cucumber essential oil. I inhaled that aroma, and it was as if my sister, who had been dead by then more than 20 years, had walked into the room. I had forgotten that that was the scent that she wore. And then last weekend, I was up in Bellingham. A dear friend of mine who died a year and a half ago, but this was the first chance because of COVID that his wife had for organizing a memorial, and it felt safe for people to come. My friend Michael was a fearless helicopter pilot. He rescued people from the most amazing, dangerous situations. He fought fires. He actually survived, some people said, 20 helicopter crashes. And everyone was telling stories of his adventures. But when it came to my time, something occurred to me, a memory came up that had nothing to do with helicopters. Michael was an avowed atheist. And he had little tolerance for what he used to refer to me and my stuff as my woo-woo beliefs. And yet, the memory I shared was when I would tell him about a retreat I had been on or something I was doing in Sims, and he could hear the enthusiasm and the interest that I talked about it. While there was one look in his eyes that said, this isn't for me, there was a deeper look, which was the love that he had for me and the appreciation for our friendship. So think about those who have died and how vivid your memories are. And what a sweet gift that is, that we have these memories. And sometimes we can think about the traits and the idiosyncrasies that maybe you hadn't thought about much before and can really bring a smile, a sense of joy as we remember that. I've talked before at Sims about my partner, Bill, who was an amazing collector. And when he died, I had this huge box of garden gloves that he found for me on the street. He never passed up a medium or large, good condition garden glove without bringing it home. And I don't know why, but I always had more lefts than rights. And here it's been over 4 years, but both his running partner, Steve, and our son, Pete, even after all this time, they still send me pictures of gloves that they find on their runs. And these memories, these favors from death, you know, really feed us and touch our hearts. The line from the poem that we are surely just passing through, along with the death is a favor to us, I think both teach us about anicca, about impermanence. You know, we go to sleep every night assuming that tomorrow is going to be just like today. You know, time and space, continuance, you know, and of course we know things change and we have our calendars and, you know, Tuesday is the events and the tasks are different than Monday. But mostly I think we believe in continuance. And then one day, you know, a loved one goes off for a run that he's done for 50 years and doesn't come home. Or you've spent weeks or months caring for and watching as someone is at the end of their lives. So what happens to our beliefs about continuance in the face of death? What happens to our beliefs about tomorrow or even just the next minute? Oh, the plans we make. Oh, the futures we envision, the attachments we have to the way we want life to be. But Hafiz says, we are just a mid-air flight of golden wine. Nothing dependable or solid, just a mid-air flight. I think even in the midst of deep grief, when the death is new, we are really open to a deeper understanding of anicca and a deeper understanding of the five recollections. You know, certainly the one that addresses our own death. I am of the nature to die. There is no way to escape death. But also the fourth recollection. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change. There is no way to escape being separated from them. Often on retreats, at least the ones that I've gone on, we will chant the impermanence chant. It's a beautiful chant in Pali, and the English translation is, all things are impermanent. They arise and they pass away. Understanding this deeply brings the greatest happiness, which is peace. So death is a favor to us, teaching us in a really deep, personal, immediate way about impermanence. And I think death opens us up to the mystery of life. This person who was so alive and so present yesterday or this morning, and then they're gone. Or even when you've been with a person in their last moments, when the last breath is taken, there's this moment of disbelief. A sense of wonder arises, like, where did they go? This deep mystery. I think one of the other ways that death is a favor to us is that it really leads us to exploring this mystery and this practice of not knowing, of living in the uncertainty of what life is going to bring to us, how life is going to unfold. Hafiz says that death is a favor to us, but our minds have lost their balance. You know, the Dharma in so many ways is really a collection of teachings about balance, the middle way, all the paradoxes in the teachings, the balance between what others say is true and our own embodied experience of truth, the balance between the way things are and the way we want them to be, or between our concepts of life and the path and meditation and the truth, the embodied truth of the full experience we live moment by moment. It's such a privilege to love and be loved by someone. And I think death and grief offer the most immediate experience of equanimity. The heart deeply, deeply feeling the gift of love connection. And at the same time, deeply feeling the pain or the loss of the being for whom we cared so deeply. Our minds have lost their balance, Hafiz says. And I think death can help us regain that sense of balance. The poets David White and John O'Donohue were dear, dear friends. And when O'Donohue died, David White describes the feeling this way. He says, falling into grief, falling toward the foundation that they held for you in your life, that you didn't even realize they were holding. Many of us have had that experience, that falling into a place where the foundation of our lives seems to have disappeared. But when we rediscover the truth that to live fully in this life means having our foundations shaken, means having our hearts broken. A broken heart is a heart broken open, one more capable of love and caring and compassion and gratitude. Death and that vivid reminder of the love we held for the person who died is a huge favor to us. Hafiz ends his poem with these lines: "The miraculous existence and impermanence of form always makes the illumined ones laugh and sing." Well, grief doesn't only encompass sadness. It holds gratitude and learning and celebration. Different cultures have all kinds of different ways of honoring those who have died. You know, gatherings with lots of music, sometimes with a lot of alcohol and dancing and partying. My tradition is, I come from a Jewish family, and we would sit Shiva for 9 days, and people would come to the home to visit with those who were grieving and to honor the dead. People write poetry and create beautiful art and music. There's crying and laughing, and sometimes the crying and laughing all happens at the same time. We light candles at the anniversary of the dead. And of course, I don't know about you, but I talk to my mom. She's been gone a long time. I talk to my sister. I talk to Bill. I tell them what's happening in my life. I sometimes ask them for advice. And sometimes I feel like I get it. So tonight we are sharing our losses. We're sharing about those we loved. We're sharing our hearts that have broken open. Perhaps we won't be laughing and singing, but remembrance includes both of those. Tonight is a night of remembrance, loss, sorrow, gratitude, and celebration. Let us welcome back our hearts that feel so deeply the joys and sorrows that come from loving another. Let us welcome in and celebrate the vulnerability we have invited into our lives when we dare to love another. Thank you.
Wow. I have no idea what I'm going to say at this point. Suze's talk was so beautiful. And she took all the great lines in the poem, too. Just listening to Suze, I had this realization of the truth of this favor that death offers us. I mean, she covered so much of the roller coaster and just the fullness of death. It's not just grief, some sadness, something we have to deal with. It's much fuller than that. So I think that's what I want to pick up on that thread there, because I remember when I went to see Venerable Panadipa, who died just about a week after I left. He died that Saturday right after I left. And I was struck by how jovial and peaceful he was about dying. Just this idea that he was in a tunnel that he couldn't get out of, trying to figure out
That's all he kept saying was, I'm trying to figure out how to get out of this tunnel. I don't really quite understand it. It was so funny. But there was a level of awareness that he was dying, that it was inevitable, and that there was almost nothing to be done about that. More just the interest of how do I move through this dying process. That's what I think balance is with death. I think there's a level of acceptance that we can come to that enables us to be with the experience as it is. But Venerable was telling me that he was not always jovial. I mean, sometimes he was frustrated, and sometimes he would get anxious and agitated, and he had all this emotional energy that would show up around the whole process. So in our ordinary minds, sometimes we can think that balance is this level of ease that nothing bothers me. But that's not really what I think the Buddha was pointing to around this death as a part of life. And I don't think that is what the balance is that Hafiz is pointing to in his poem. What I think the balance is that we're pointing to is a balance that allows space for the difficulty of death. You know, my son has terminal cancer. My youngest son has terminal cancer. And when he got diagnosed, and they said he basically had a year to live, even though he's lived 2 years, I started reading up on the Bardos and the Tibetan practice. And it's kind of a strange thing that happens when you read up and practice with death, both in the Bardo practice for the Tibetans, and then some of you, many of you, have gone through Vinny's year to live program, and there's all these different, like Venerable Nalio has a death contemplation as part of the Satipatthana. There are all these ways in which we can practice with this idea of death. But what is striking is how alive you become when you practice with death. You would think that if I practice with death, I'm just going to be stuck in the pain and sorrow like the pain we've all felt with those kids died. So you would think that, if I practice with death, that's where I'm going to go. Or maybe the sorrow and grief that seemed overwhelming when someone close to you died. In our ordinary minds, we would think, if I practice with this death, I'm going to be overwhelmed with grief. But for those of us that have actually practiced with death, it does not have that kind of experience. It's very different. There's something about coming into an acknowledgement of the truth of impermanence and death that allows us to truly step into and appreciate life as it is. That there's a way that the acceptance of the natural endings of things, endings of life, endings itself, allows us to see the beginning and presence of things more fully. There is a sutta where the Buddha saw someone he knew, must have known, because he calls the man's name out. I don't remember the man's name, but let's just say his name was Mr. Jones. So the Buddha saw Mr. Jones walking and he said, "Mr. Jones, what is wrong with you? You don't look like yourself. Right? Something's wrong. What's wrong?" And Mr. Jones said, "I lost my son. It's his only son." And he just says, "I don't think I can go on. I don't think I can make it." The Buddha says, "Yes, I understand. You know, loved ones bring us such grief." So Mr. Jones said, "What are you saying? What are you saying? It's my son's fault that I'm so sad right now?" The Buddha says, "Yeah, family, the attachment to family brings such difficulty." Now, attachment to loved ones, I think he said. I don't think he said family. Anyway, the man got really, really upset with the Buddha and he left. And he started telling people that the Buddha said it was his dead son's fault that he was grieving. And how could the Buddha say that? How could he be so cruel? So it eventually got to the queen, who was a follower of the Buddha. And she sends word to the Buddha to say, What did you mean? Why would you say that?" And the Buddha sent word back that because of this human condition, we are necessarily attached to the people we love. That it comes with the human condition. So we are born and there's an attachment to mother. We are born, there's attachment to father. We grow up with siblings. There's an attachment to our siblings. We have children and there's an attachment to children. And he was sharing to her that it's not the children or our loved ones that cause the pain. It's the attachment. But that to live in this human existence, we are going to have attachment. And we are going to feel that pain. The two are one and the same. When you begin to see that that dukkha is inherently a part of being human, then you can begin to recognize the joy of actually being with someone when they're alive. That instead of just flippantly assuming people's lives are going to continue, that every day we can have a degree of appreciation for their presence here, simply because we know inherent in this existence, there will be death and there will be separation. I think that's what those practices on death contemplation brings us. Contemplating on our own death brings a sense of appreciation almost at the level of Scrooge when he realized it was still Christmas Day and he still could go get the duck or goose or whatever and make things right. That's what we have. Every time we realize we have not died, we have the opportunity to awaken, to re-understand, to see beyond the limitation of our ordinary habitual minds. Every time we come to understand that, because there's going to come a time when we are going to die and we will not have the opportunity to correct or apologize or make amends or tell someone I love you. They're going to die and we won't have that time. So this contemplation on death actually puts us in the balance that allows us to remember how fleeting our lives actually is. I want to end with this one last line. Probably the best line in the whole poem here is as the master poured this beer into the glasses, so as the master poured, I would be reminded, I would be reminded that all I know of life and myself is that we are just the flight of golden wine between his pitcher and his cup. Got to get that for a moment. When you go into the kitchen and get ready to fill your cup with water, get some water in your glass. Just think of the time it takes the water to leave the spout and get into the cup. When you get some tea, think of the time it takes to pour the water into the cup. That our existence is that short of time. It doesn't seem like it because we live in present moment awareness. But it is very, very short. And so any opportunity we have to recognize that we have not died, that a loved one has not died, is an opportunity to experience the joy of that. So let's just sit here for a couple of minutes, and then we'll continue on.
The Hafiz poem is what we read earlier, and you can just take that with you. Mm-hmm. And the Kaddish poem is what we're going to do a call and response, but we're encouraging people to not to keep yourselves muted because it's going to be really loud. So Kaddish.
Can you mute Marilyn?
Kaddish is a part of the Jewish service that is in every single service, whether it's Sabbath or a holiday. And this is an interpretation of the Kaddish prayer. But it's a way for us to remember all of those who have been mentioned this evening and those who are just we hold in our hearts. Yeah. At the rising of the sun and at its going down, we remember them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for those of you who are in the room, it's fine to say we remember them out loud here. At the blowing of the wind and in the chill of winter,
We remember them.
At the opening of the buds and in the rebirth of spring,
we remember them.
At the shining of the sun and in the warmth of summer,
we remember them.
At the rustling of the leaves and in the beauty of autumn, we remember them. At the beginning of the year and at its end,
we remember them.
As long as we live, they too will live, for they are a part of us as we remember them. When we are weary and in need of strength,
we remember them.
When we are lost and sick at heart,
we remember them.
When we have joy we crave to share,
we remember them.
When we have decisions that are difficult to make,
we remember them.
When we have achievements that are based on theirs,
we remember them.
As long as we live, they too will live, for they are a part of us as we remember them.
So in this last part, we are going to close and have a little bit of metta, and share the merit of all of our practice. So I really want to, before I close, I want to give a shout out and kind of thank Suze for her energy around this celebration. I think several years she has suggested that on Memorial Day, we do something to acknowledge and celebrate the people who have died in our lives. And I think last year was the first time that we finally said, okay, that's what we're going to do as an annual ceremonial thing. And this is the second time we've done it. But I swear it lifts my heart so much that we do this. There's something about bringing difficulty into ceremony when we're all together that helps us hold it as a Sangha together. And so I really am grateful to Suze for her persistence and her dedication towards, I think it was after Bill died, that there was this, it began, you know, and it's been five years?
Almost.
This persistence. And so I really want to acknowledge and appreciate that. And thank you all for being here. And I hope that we continue this process long into the years, because death will be with us a long time. So with that, before I share the merit, before we say any kind of metta, if anyone would like to just say the names of some people we'd like to share, it can be people that are, you know, like Sue said at the beginning, who are around this grieving process. So it could be like I'd like to share with the families and all those who knew the kids at in the school in Texas. But it can be anybody who you can think of that you'd like to share some of the strength of our practice. And you can just unmute yourself, say their names, and then mute yourself, and it's fine. Or you can just say their names in the room.
Sarah. Worry.
Mother.
Calvin.
Sorry, Calvin.
My mom, Jerry. My dad, George. My dad, Jeff. My cousin, Christine. And friends, Deborah and John.
My sister Amelia.
All right. Is there anyone else?
My son, Jason Gibbons.
Okay. So it's not until we say it out loud that we realize how much pain there is in the world, how much fear and how much grief and just how much difficulty people are holding in the world. I like it when we say it out loud so that we know that the difficulty itself is much harder for us to bear alone. But there's something about being in community as a collective when we say it out loud and we know that we're holding this difficulty with other beings and that we're all holding it together, then it becomes possible to bear whatever. I believe strongly that this practice is not contained within our own minds. I've seen it too much on retreat. I've seen retreat after retreat after retreat where we come into a room, all of us with scattered minds and thoughts about this and that, and it's just a hodgepodge of energy that's swirling around in the hall. And then even over the course of a couple of days, the room begins to get settled. And there's a way in which we share our peace with other people. And when I share my peace with you, you have the ability to increase your peace. And if you share your peace with me, we begin to increase this peace and stillness in the room. And there's a way in which that concentration, tranquility, whatever you want to call it, creates a space where whatever is arising in our minds, in our bodies, whatever becomes difficult over the next few days, we can hold it. We can be with it. I've seen that happen on so many retreats with so many people. People who, in their initial interviews, never believed they could hold the difficulty that they came into the retreat with. And then I've watched them sit through sit after sit after sit in stillness. So this practice that we do, it's not contained within ourselves. It may not seem like it can flow and radiate out into a world that's as challenged and as angry and afraid as this world is, but it does. I always tell myself, if it were not for the millions of practitioners all over the world, we would surely be lost. Instead, it may be difficult, but it's all of us that are practicing and sharing our stillness and peace that enables us to get up and face another day. That keeps basically the overwhelm of rage contained at the level it is. So for all the people we mentioned and all the people we thought about in our minds and didn't mention, and for all the people who need some support that no one even notices, no one sees them, no one knows, they keep it to themselves, for the people who are isolated and those who are grieving and don't think they can make another day because of a loss. For the people who have to support all these people who have lost someone dear to them and they don't believe they can make another day. For the people who are living with the fear that death is closer than they expected. And for the people who have lost dear ones many, many, many years ago and still struggle with holding the fact that that happened, may whatever support, light, and beneficial energy that can come from our practice radiate out into the world and land softly upon their shoulders. May it remind them that we go through dukkha, not away from it, that we go through suffering and we embrace it, and that's where our liberation lies. May their hearts be settled from the stillness of our own minds and hearts. May it radiate some degree of stillness within theirs. And they have a respite of some type. And may they at some point, no matter how painful things are, may they at some point find a measure of joy and ease of well-being. May there be peace. May there be peace. May there be peace.